From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Early next month, it will be 54 years since then U.S. President Dwight Eisenhower's press secretary, James Hagerty, in the waning days of the Eisenhower administration, made the following statement at a press conference on January 3, 1961.
There is a limit to what the United States and self-respect can endure. That limit has now been reached. Our friendship for the Cuban people is not affected. It is my hope and my conviction that in the not-too-distant future, it will be possible for the historic friendship between us once again to find reflection in normal relations of every sort. Meanwhile, our sympathy goes out to the people of Cuba, now suffering under the yoke of a dictator.
Officially, the sanctions that accompanied the break in relations were imposed after Cuba had demanded that the U.S. scale back its massive embassy staff in Havana to the same size as that of the Cuban embassy in Washington. But it was the example of the Cuban Revolution, more than any actions taken by the new revolutionary government in Havana, that had captured the attention of the U.S. State Department and the CIA during 1960. According to an official memorandum of discussion at the 467th meeting of the National Security Council, held in Augusta, Georgia on November 17, 1960, about 6 weeks before the U.S. closed its embassy in Havana, U.S. CIA Director Alan Dulles characterized events in Havana at the top of the list among what the memo termed, quote, significant world developments affecting U.S. security, closed quote. The memo blamed recent attempts at revolution in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua on what Dulles called Castroitis, which he said was affecting Central America and parts of South America. At that meeting, Secretary of State Christian Herter commented that the overall picture presented by Dulles was accurate, but not pleasant. He suggested that the U.S.-led Organization of American States call a consultative meeting to name an investigative group, adding that he was hopeful that this process would lead to the OAS taking specific sanctions against Cuba. That discussion and the sanctions which had already been proposed in mid-1960 faced only one member of the inner circle looking at the challenges from Cuba, Philip Bonsall, who turned out to be the last U.S. ambassador to the island nation, dissenting. Bonsall had argued that proposed cuts of imports of some 900,000 tons of Cuban sugar would inevitably accelerate expropriations of U.S.-owned properties there, expand and deepen support for Fidel Castro and the revolutionary government, and halt any regional tendency to support the U.S. against Havana. He instead counseled holding to a policy of diplomatic pressure to seek redress of U.S. grievances. Bonsall's conciliatory approach was poorly received by leading members of the U.S. Congress and other Cold Warriors inside the administration, who felt his methods were an appeasement of communism. He was withdrawn from his post after serving barely a year in office. Diplomatic relations were broken, an ever-increasing regime of sanctions was imposed and periodically expanded. Support for the revolution did indeed grow, both within Cuba and throughout the region, and a condition of alienation between Havana and Washington was created that has endured to this day. One major increase in the sanctions regime was signed into law in March 1996 by then-President Bill Clinton, the so-called Helms-Burton Act, named for former segregationist Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina and Tea Party member Representative Dan Burton. Early in his term, Clinton had promised to review the sanctions regime against Cuba. However, his public position changed in February of 1996 when a group of anti-Castro Cuban exiles based in Miami, calling themselves Brothers to the Rescue, began running small aircraft into the country to deliver flyers and, according to the Cuban government, commit terrorist acts against the island nation. The Cuban Air Force, after issuing a number of warnings to previous flights, shot down a pair of Cessna Skymasters, killing the four men aboard. Shortly after the incident, on February 26, 1996, Clinton made the following statement.
Saturday's attack is further evidence that Havana has become more desperate in its efforts to deny freedom to the people of Cuba. Now the downing of these planes demands a firm response from both the United States and the international community. I am pleased that the European Union today strongly condemned the action. Last night, on my instructions, Ambassador Albright convened an emergency session of the United Nations Security Council to condemn the Cuban action and to present the case for sanctions on Cuba until it agrees to abide by its obligation to respect civilian aircraft and until it compensates the families of the victims. Today, I am also ordering the following unilateral actions. First, I am asking that Congress pass legislation that will provide immediate compensation to the families, something to which they are entitled under international law, out of Cuba's blocked assets here in the United States. If Congress passes this legislation, we can provide the compensation immediately. Second, I will move promptly to reach agreement with the Congress on the pending Helms-Burton Cuba legislation so that it will enhance the effectiveness of the embargo in a way that advances the cause of democracy in Cuba. Third, I have ordered that Radio Martí expand its reach. All the people of Cuba must be able to learn the truth about the regime in Havana, the isolation it has earned for itself through its contempt for basic human rights and international law. Fourth, I am ordering that additional restrictions be put on travel in the United States by Cuban officials who reside here, and that visits by Cuban officials to our country be further limited. Finally, all charter air travel from the United States to Cuba will be suspended indefinitely. These deliberate actions are the right ones at this time. They respond to Havana in a way that serves our goals of accelerating the arrival of democracy in Cuba. But I am not ruling out any further steps in the future, should they be required. Saturday's attack was an appalling reminder of the nature of the Cuban regime, repressive, violent, scornful of international law. In our time, democracy has swept the globe. From the Philippines exactly 10 years ago, to Central and Eastern Europe, to South Africa, to Haiti, to all but one nation in our hemisphere, I will do everything in my power to see that this historic tide reaches the shores of Cuba. And let me close by extending, on behalf of our family and our country, our deepest condolences to those and the families of those who lost their lives. Thank you very much.
The sanctions imposed at that time still remain, and most were not affected by yesterday's announcements. One of the voices expressing approval of yesterday's developments in U.S.-Cuba relations was U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Stephanie Kutrix reports from the United Nations.
The normalization of diplomatic relations between the United States and Cuba has been heartily welcomed by the UN Secretary General. On Wednesday, U.S. President Barack Obama announced the two countries would resume relations, which would include the opening of an American embassy in Havana for the first time in more than 50 years. UN Chief Ban Ki-moon said he had been informed of this development in advance by the U.S. government, calling it very positive news.
I'd like to thank President Barack Obama of the United States and President Raul Castro for taking this very important step towards normalizing relations. As much of the membership of the United Nations have repeatedly emphasized through General Assembly resolutions during last many, many years, it is time that Cuba and the United States normalize their bilateral relations.
Mr. Ban added that the UN stands ready to help both countries to cultivate their good neighborly relations. Last October, the General Assembly voted for the 23rd time for the U.S. to end the economic, commercial, and financial embargo against Cuba. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
CPR's program director, Bernard White, spoke Thursday with Rosemary Mealy, adjunct assistant professor at City College of New York's CUNY Center for Worker Education, and the author of Fidel and Malcolm X, Memories of a Meeting, and Professor Gerald Horn, African-American historian and author who currently holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore Chair of History and African-American Studies at the University of Houston, about the implications of Wednesday's announcement of a restoration of diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba.
Does this really mean that the U.S. Is going to normalize relationship with Cuba? What does this really mean? Rosemary?
Well, you know, I think you raise a very important point that somehow there's an attempt to dismiss an entire 50 years of aggression against the country as if normalizing relationships are going to just be a situation where we should just forget the past in terms of all of the things that have happened to Cubans and the Cuban society over the past 50 years. But I think that there are a couple of things that I want to point out about the conference yesterday, and that is I just finished watching a very emotional video of the arrival of the remainder of three Cuban spies who were held political prisoners in this country for the past 16 years. And it was and indeed a historic event for the Cuban people, because their arrival in Havana has a lot to do with the international movements that had emerged to free the Cuban Five. So I think that that's an important piece that we're not hearing in this whole discussion. The other thing I think that's important to point out is that the fact that normalization of relationships does not mean that somehow the Helms-Burton Bill, which is that draconian law that says that U.S. citizens are not allowed freely to travel to Cuba, is something that is not being discussed yet. Normalizations also mean a relationship to the possibility of more trade relations in Cuba. And just briefly, I noted yesterday a couple of reports that came out on after the closing of the stock market, and that Carnival Cruise Lines saw, I think, was something like a 3% jump in its shares, along with the Norwegian Cruise Line, which also saw some shares edging up to 1.5%. And I just mentioned those two companies in relationship of who's going to benefit, quote-unquote, with this normalization. I think also that the Cubans are very well aware of what this means. I was reading the Cuban newspaper, Granma, and clearly normalization for them does not mean that it's going to be a one-sided situation, that they're planning to continue along the road of socialist construction in their country, recognizing the difficulties that they've had over the past 40 years in doing this in the face of U.S. aggression. So normalization of relationships, as we're getting it in this country, somehow falling along the lines of human rights, you know, challenging so-called human rights violations in the country. And there's a lot of anti-communism here, and that's the thing that's really interesting when you listen to all of the news reports. Everyone's talking about Cuba in terms of human rights violations, the lack of free press, et cetera, but they're not, you know, they really don't want to acknowledge the fact that a socialist society has been developing 90 miles off the shores of this country. So a lot of the opposition that we're hearing is actually coming from the vein of an ideological opposition to the kind of society that Cuba has been able to build over the past 50 or so years.
Gerald, is this basically a business deal? I know that Cargill is very excited about this also.
In part, in fact, in terms of what has not been covered by the mainstream press, we need to analyze how this overture to Cuba may and probably will exacerbate class tensions, that is to say, inter-ruling class tensions in the United States. You see that in the Wall Street Journal editorial this morning, where that Neanderthal right-wing publication gives a tentative thumbs up to the overture, although it's reluctant because it recognizes that the mafia in South Florida has been a major bastion of support for the white right in the United States. At the same time, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has embraced this deal. And of course, agribusiness has embraced this deal. Telecommunications in the United States has embraced this deal. And as you noted, car manufacturers have embraced this deal as well. But to step back for a moment to look at the big picture, we need to look at it dialectically. That is to say, there's no doubt that this represents a major victory for the Cuban Revolution. At the same time, we need to recognize that what's happening is that the United States is trying to develop a new mode of subversion of the Cuban Revolution, since the old mode, as they keep saying, has not worked. Keep in mind that just before the attack on Libya in 2011, Colonel Gaddafi in Tripoli had made overtures to the United States, and apparently relations had warmed. And by 2011, October, he had been assassinated. Secondly, with regard to the rhetoric that you so correctly focused on in your introductory remarks, for those of us who are familiar with U.S. movies, this is a familiar scenario. Basically, the United States is backing out of the saloon with both guns blazing. That is to say that there is a tendency both in U.S. ruling circles, and I might add also in Black America, that when you retreat furiously, you cannot appear to be doing so. You always have to be seeming to advance. And I understand why Black Americans do that, because you have to maintain that sort of posture in the face of police terror and all the rest. You have to maintain that sort of aggressive attitude. Now, with regard to the United States, they cannot afford to admit to themselves that one of the reasons motivating this deal on the U.S. side, and this is absent from the mainstream media, is the deteriorating global position of U.S. imperialism. That is to say, we hear a lot about how Cuba needed to make this deal because of the fall in the oil prices, which is impacting its chief ally in Caracas, and also is impacting Moscow, which is a major oil exporter. What you don't hear is that China, which surpassed the United States by some measures as the leading global economic power, has established quite a significant toehold, not only in Cuba, but in the Caribbean generally, particularly in the Bahamas, right off the coast of Florida. And you may also recall that in June 2013, right before President Xi Jinping of China went to the Sunnyland Summit in Southern California with Obama, that he met with all the Caribbean leaders in Trinidad, which led to massive deals. And anybody who's visited the Caribbean lately sees the Chinese footprint. And so Washington feels that it has to countervail that influence. Washington is also in the position, it seems to me, that the apartheid authorities were in 1989. That is to say, they had jailed Nelson Mandela and political prisoners. But by 1989 and 1990, January, it seemed that Nelson Mandela had been the jailer. That is to say, that he held the key to unlocking the dilemma of Pretoria. And similarly, Washington has, to its credit, admitted that its ability to knock together an America's enterprise so as to better confront China, that is to say, better compete with Brazil, which has its own ambitions with regard to the hemisphere, that Cuba policy was an impediment, particularly in the run-up to this Panama summit that's going to take place in a few months. And by the way, you should know that some of us have been talking about mounting a campaign for the detention of the U.S. leadership once they arrived in Panama because of the torture that had been inflicted not only in these so-called black sites, according to the Feinstein Report, in Morocco, Poland, Romania, etc., but also, of course, because of the torture of black Americans, including murder in the streets of Ferguson and Staten Island and elsewhere. And presumably, this idea of detaining the entire U.S. leadership because of human rights violations, just like Augusto Pinochet of Chile was detained in London for months on end because of an effort by a Spanish magistrate to arrest him for human rights violations against Spanish nationals in Chile. Presumably, we'll have to rethink that now, but certainly if I were the travel agent of the U.S. leadership, but not to mention George Bush, Dick Cheney, and Condoleezza Rice, I'd have second thoughts about sending them anywhere abroad. Thirdly, With regard to the new methods of subversion, keep in mind that according to this deal, remittances, that is to say, Cuban Americans sending money to their relatives on the island, will quadruple. Now, this will probably exacerbate class and race tensions on the island, because we all know that the so-called Euro-Cubans tend to have more capital on the North American mainland than their African counterparts. And we all know that with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the inauguration of the so-called special period, that that helped to exacerbate those sorts of tensions. And with the quadrupling of remittances according to this new deal, it's something that obviously the forces and the comrades on the island are going to have to be very vigilant about. Fourth, I think that we also need to look at the impact on regional tourism. You mentioned, or perhaps Rosemary mentioned, Carnival, the tourists, Carnival cruise, the send ships throughout the islands. We're going to have to ask ourselves what's going to be the impact on Jamaica and Antigua and other islands, because we know that historically, Cuba had been the major center of U.S. tourism. I mean, tourism in, say, places like Jamaica really is a post-1948-1949 phenomenon. You could read about this in my book, Race to Revolution in the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. And with more U.S. tourists going to Havana, we're going to have to ask ourselves what are going to be the ripple effects regionally. And then finally, in historic terms, obviously two of the major developments over the past 200 years have been the Cuban Revolution on the one hand, the Haitian Revolution on the other. It's quite striking that a half century after the commencement of the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, the U.S. imperialists and colonialists were basically able to engineer a split in the island, leading to the origins of the Dominican Republic, a sovereign state as we speak, exacerbating class and color tensions on the island of Hispaniola that have yet to be extinguished. And it would be a useful exercise both for students and revolutionaries to ask how and why it is that a half century after 1959 and the commencement of the Cuban Revolution, Cuba emerges with a triumph. Whereas if you look at the Haitian Revolution, and by the way, my book on that will be out next year, it led in many ways to a severe wound in Hispaniola, with that Haiti arguably has yet to recover from.
And also, thank you for that, Gerald. The one of the issues that I was thinking about also was Cuban internationalism, particularly in Southern Africa. There has been the Cuban presence in helping them to eliminate colonialism in that part of the world. And we African Americans, for the most part, those who are aware of what took place, applaud that effort. And we know that apartheid might still be in place if it was not for Cuban internationalism. How is this going to, this relationship, how might it affect Cuban internationalism? Because they have Cuba down as being a terrorist state. They'll have to eradicate that in order to have a normalized relationship. Rosemary?
Well, you know, every year, I think we go back to the United Nations, every year for the past, I would say more than 30 years, every nation in the UN has voted to lift the blockade because it recognized how draconian it was, how unlawful it was, the violations of international human rights. And it's interesting how on the heels of the last vote, where the U.S. again was isolated, I think Israel always votes with the U.S. and a couple of other what I would call rogue U.S. states. So the internationalism exists. It has existed far more in a recognizable way than people in this country even know. I mean, the most latest thing is Cuba's role in the area of global health care with the Ebola outbreaks in Africa. and Cuba's role in terms of sending more than 200 healthcare workers, and even those workers who were already on the continent, committing themselves to working in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and other countries where that epidemic is ravaging. So on an international level, every time I think the U.S. recognizes any country who has made some kind of input into the cultural progress of that country, the health progress of that country, it sees a need also to insert itself. I don't think that I clearly do not believe that this quote-unquote opening will have any impact in terms of Cuba's role internationally and people recognizing the honesty and the sincerity of Cuban internationalists and the role that Cuba has played on an international within the international forum. The other point to your question, I think that unless African Americans are freely allowed to travel to the country, we will never really see the impact and the progress of that country, because that's why I think that now the focus should be on congressional to remove the travel restrictions. And then, of course, that's going to be a tough thing given the makeup of both the Senate, the current Senate and Congress. But let's try to be progressive. And so now the solidarity movement in this country in particular will have to refocus and reshift its work to demanding that that all of those draconian laws, the Helms-Burton Act, that those be repealed, and all the things that go into that act, which really denies our having access to what is going on in the country. Just regular folk. I'm not talking about the delegations who are still allowed to travel. You have the educators who can go, but just average folk who may want to go and see what's going on there. And then the cultural exchanges that exist, that will exist between there and here. The other point, moving away from the international piece, the other thing that keeps coming up in the discussion, even from the president who made it a focus, is that somehow in Cuba there is this lack of free flow of ideas, free flow of exchanging of ideas, and I want to just say that, you know, we need to understand that Cuba in many ways has and always has been focused on developing its connectivity towards the development of telecommunications and its infrastructure capacity. But it has done so with the purpose of strengthening what it calls social connectivity in areas of education, health care, and of course, and it's not like, you know, people don't have access to the internet or to emails or what have you. That already exists. But the priority has been to develop an infrastructure that's going to improve the educational system, passing knowledge from the institutions to the people, and because they have not had the resources to develop this extensive infrastructure for massive email access. So it's not as if the way we're getting it is that somehow people don't have access to information, they don't have access to the internet, not at the scale or the level that we have it in this country, because the priority in the face, and again, in the face of 50 years of surveillance from this country, four generations of wars against the country, and the economic siege that the country has been living under. So that's another way in which the media in this country is presenting itself. It's somehow with a lack of access to Facebook, which Cubans do have access to, that somehow they're in a century that has no knowledge of the technology that exists. The technology is there. It just has the focus of developing it has not been the focus to do so from an individual basis, but to look at developing the technology institutionally that's going to advance education, culture, and economics. I think that's an important piece to challenge.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. Community Public Radio. I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.